from your head into your whole body. And as soon as your brain isn't going, does your brain work on images from what hasn't happened yet? Can you think of something before you've ever had an experience of it or heard anybody talk about it? Why? Because everything that you think is based on the past. Everything. So whenever you're trying to figure out what to do, you're basically asking, what did I do in the past? And it suddenly struck me one day that I actually wasn't a fully awakened being yet. And that maybe this was the opportunity. And was I bringing up old records to play them? Was I learning any new lyrics? Pretty straightforward. So when you find yourself too much caught in trying to react to somebody, rather than being present and being open to the experience, you don't have as many choices. In the Sakya tradition, they have this saying, His Holiness Sakya Trenzin Rinpoche made this quote when I received some teachings from him about 5 years ago. 5 years ago? More than 5 years ago now. Consciousness that is not in the future, therefore clear. Not in the past, therefore unobstructed. Unobstructed by what you already know. Present, therefore. Not in the future, therefore aware. Not in the past, therefore unobstructed. Present, therefore clear. Isn't that beautiful? So what I was saying about purse is very much the same kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're not in the future, you're not in the past, you're present. When you're wiggling your toes, you get good at wiggling them one direction, so then see if you can wiggle them a new way. When you get the big one, go to the little one. Then you're never in the present. You know, you're always bringing yourself into the present. When you're good at the little one, go to the one of the middle ones. When you're good at all of them, then try to move each one without moving the others. When you really get good at that, try to move the middle toe without moving any of the others. As that is physically impossible, but your brain will never believe it if you're good at all the others. It'll last you until you're dead. I guarantee it. But, you know, the toes are very useful, and they're usually in shoes, so nobody sees them. You know, and you can sit there and be talking to someone, and be aware of your feet, listening to them, and be aware. It's just that you don't have to be jumping on them, or defending yourself. You're present, you're clearly, unobstructedly aware. Then all options are open to you. How's that? It will work for you. And if it works for you, then helps the 3-year-old. Or you're going to try to get the 3-year-old to see if they can just wiggle one toe. I've tried that. It works with kids. Also, the other thing about it, or it has for me, the other thing about it is once you teach yourself that habit, as soon as you start to wiggle the toes, you tend to go into the same state. Once you've done it a few times, we get programmed really well, don't we? So to program ourselves with good habits, I mean, like, why not? I mean, we love to habituate, so throw in a few good habits is just exactly what you should do, from my understanding anyway.
then breathing, you could, you know, replace the toes with just breathing.
Well, basically, that's what breathing does, you know, basically. But what the toes do, that's one more, is it actually, if you're in a very agitated mental state, it physiologically brings the blood flow into a more balanced. Usually when you're doing the breathing meditation, you're not in a greatly, you know, at various periods it happens. But so this is more like for daily work, but I've used it sometimes in meditation. Very useful. But there are periods in meditation where that's what's happening, where there's just really a lot. It was in one of the Buddha scriptures, I can't remember which one, that where Buddha was talking about you're going on a path. Oh no, it's from the tarot. You know the tarot deck? Have you seen much of it? Yeah. And the moon card, you know the moon card? Starts with a pond with a sort of a, I know scorpions didn't live in water, but sort of a crabby scorpion. Kind of, I mean, a scorpio, of course, are not crabby scorpions. They're actually very spiritual. Quite spiritual. Yeah, I'm done. Okay, the commercial is over. Okay, Sagittarius Earth. I don't get enough, you know, to like really try to put it to my brother. So this is like so much fun for me to remember. I can just turn one. He's too polite to answer immediately. No, none of that. All right. So the pond is there. And there's this kind of Scorpio thingy coming out of it, like called from the depths of the mud, through the muddy water, eventually transcending that level of existence, coming out onto land. There's a black dog and a white dog on either side of the pond. And this path that goes up through some trees, and then it goes down a little bit, and then up a bigger bit, and then down, and then up, and then down, you know, near the mountains, you know exactly what that is, until there's a mountain with a crown on it. And when you're on that path, when you're, the teaching in the tarot is that when you begin to move out of being, you know, unable to see past your own sort of instinctive hopes and fears, and you're beginning to learn how to move from being totally involved with trying to survive and start to be more interested in a different realm, which is the realm of altruism, and you get past arguing about it with good and bad and move along the path, quit barking at good and bad and move along the path and through a few forests and up and down and up and down. As you get higher, you see a really good view of that mountain, and you know you're going to get to it there. And then as you were climbing along, then the path goes down, and suddenly you're in the trees again, and you can't see where you are. And some people, they go back up. Instead of saying, well, I know I am following the path. And both are necessary, not only outer signs, but inner. Faith. So in Buddhism, how they say that is faith and intelligence must work together. Because faith without intelligence is stupid. And intelligence without faith just sits around and says, yeah, that looks like a pretty good place. I think I'll take another picture of it. So is that reasonable?
Reminds me of a line from Macbeth. I stand now so knee deep in blood, it gives less sense to go back and go forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But that living experience.
Yeah.
In Christ.
Right in the center, yeah. Exactly. Any other? Some of you are not going to ask me a question no matter what I ask. So I see a show of hands on that, please.
You mentioned the first two of the precepts and the hooks in them. What about the other three?
So, what is it? Okay, killing and harming, not taking what isn't freely given. What's the next one?
Sexual acts. Sexual acts.
That's fourth or fifth, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I can. Huh?
Intoxicants. Intoxicants.
Yeah. Yeah. That's five, and fourth is unwholesome sense. Lying. There. Next one is lying. And lying, there are four kinds of lying. It's actually not lying, it's false speech. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, I know the laundry list once I remember what they are. Lying, there are four kinds. First kind is where you actually leave something out when you know that it will make a difference. That means you know it was this, but instead you say this. That's what we usually call lying. It's kind of lying. It's called... The word translates... The translator of the word is hatchet. Is when you use words like a hatchet to cut someone. Especially someone who isn't there, but you actually hatchet job somebody with your language. That's called false speech. The next one is from demonizing. Demonizing. The word basically is the word for demonizing. Where you use language to demonize or to make something. You're not just saying, well, you know, that person, you know, they just never think of anybody else, or, oh yeah, he's totally incapable of having a good relationship, or any of that stuff. That's hatchet. Or they're not really a meditator, or anything like that. But you say, you know, those Germans in the Second World War, they are just unfeeling bastards, and they just think they're the only right people in the world. Or those Jews in the Second World War, they are just rats and they're not really human. Or those Negroes, or those whites, or those, you know, or those rats, or those... wolves. I was going to say coyotes. Do you have many coyotes around here? A lot? Those coyotes, or they go ripping down outside my window almost every night. I leave my window open. But any time you demonize something to make it lesser than respectful in its life, within its own life. That's demonizing, that's the third kind. And the fourth kind, the word comes from the word, if you've done any gardening, you probably know the word pollard. P-O-L-L-A-R-D. It actually means when you cut a tree so that it won't bear fruit on those limbs. And it came from like castration of animals or things like that. It used to be an old word. It's only survived in gardening circles now. Mm-hmm. And it basically is using words to castrate life, which is often translated as gossip. But it really means dead speech. It's very interesting, isn't it? So those are the four kinds of false speech. I undertake to train myself to refrain from false speech. It's often called lying, but it's like false speech. And then the next one has to do with sexual misconduct, doesn't it? Is that right? And,
Your translation of she gave me, you used the word sensual.
Yeah, it is actually sensual misconduct if you actually translate the text, the words used in. And it basically means because sexuality is our strongest kind of image of sensuality, that's the one that it ends up being used at, but it basically means indulging yourself over the wishes of those around you, where your own sensual desires cause you to seduce, overwhelm in any way, you know, ignore the honor of the entire environment around you. That's what it basically originally was meant, was used as. And the final one, to avoid using substances that intoxicate the mind, has basically the sense of not creating a greater problem of addiction. So those are the five basic precepts that when people decide they would like to follow the Buddhist path, they would take those precepts, and they're called the training precepts, and they all start, I undertake to train myself, in the old school, that's how they start. And sometimes you find them stated more, I will not, but in fact they are meant to be a training, because at some point or other you have to acknowledge that when you eat, it's an intoxicant. When you've been in a really stuffy room and you get outside and you start breathing, you don't want to go in again, and it's an intoxicant. Do you understand? And it's bloody impossible not to tell a lie because of the nature of words. If I say this word, there's all these other words that would also have fit, but this word misses that much of it, but it gets most of these. This word catches this that this doesn't, but it doesn't catch this. And is that true? Mm-hmm. Whenever you say a word, it's not the word you're depending on, it's the intention. So all of the precepts, to my understanding, and I have received some teaching on this, but I have also received teaching that is not emphasized this way. So it's up to you to work with it yourself. All of them, to my mind, basically point to it is your aspiration that is important. And the Buddha said, karma or action is chetana or intention. It's the intention, not the action. You know, and I know, that you've seen two different people do the similar act in different circumstances, and one it's like shameful and the other it's not shameful. Right? You see somebody grab a little kid out of bed when the house is on fire, it's not shameful. See somebody grab a little kid out of bed when she's coming home drunk, it's shameful. Same action, right? What is the difference? The intention. So Buddha over and over again and many times, but the briefest he said it was karma is chetana. Action, karma, action is motive. And the thing you work with is not your actions, but your aspirations. You can have all the desire in the world, but if your aspiration is to not get caught in it, then you act on your aspiration. Right? You watch the desire. You don't have to change it. It'll change itself. It's just that tree, that train. Ho hum, space between boxcars. Ho hum, train's gone. Ho hum, okay, now, oh, maybe I won't. Here comes another train. So there's the four.
And again, the Buddha is asking to
absolutely.
The object of meditation.
Exactly. Exactly. And from every angle, huh, Larry? From every angle, looking at that subject-object relationship. Mm-hmm. Until eventually you're more interested in what the subject is evoking than what, you know, for the benefit of not only the subject, but the subject and the object, then being caught up. That whole quality of that is so beautiful. We're actually looking at who's whole. And with kindness, not, you know, you don't need the brass knuckles. I mean, that's warping. When you go further and decide you want to take more training, then there are the eight first, which are called the novice rules, and then there's the ten, well, sort of pre-novice, and then the ten, which are the novice rules, and then you get into the hundreds. The first four remain very important, and one of those is to not very similar, like the first rule of Christianity: "I am the Lord God, no one else before me," kind of thing. In Buddhism, it's to not create, I can't remember the word now, but to not in any way put your projections on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Not to cause them to seem worse, which is along there with murder and creating a schism amongst practitioners, because then you're not doing the practice. You're too caught up in practicing yourself. So how can you make any spiritual practice if your idea of a spiritual practice is to give yourself, you know, perfectly pleated robes and make everybody else look like they just got out of a mud bath? It's not going to be, that's not spiritual. Is it? It's very interesting getting that part of the books of the Buddhist teaching. There are like 40-odd of them, 40-odd Bibles in Buddhism, and one-third of them are called, or they're divided into three parts, which are called baskets, because they used to be carried around in baskets. And three of a collection of baskets were sort of this color, so that you could tell, oh, that's the Abhidhamma Pitika, or basket. That's the basket of Abhidhamma, although there was more than one basket. And then there was another basket that was called the Sutta Pitika, or the herd Pitika, herd basket. And that was a collection of the 45 odd years, or maybe a few even ones too, who knows, of the Buddha walking around, talking to different people all over, mostly in northern India and Nepal, but other places as well, various ones are my favorite, like when the woman came in who was like very intelligent, and she had one child, and she was on her own, and then her child got ill and died when her child was quite young, and she was like crazed with grief, and she was carrying the child's body around asking all the doctors and everyone to heal it, and it was very warm where she lived, and she'd been carrying the body for a few days. And so people were starting to hit her and throw her, you know, get away, you stupid, crazy woman, and, you know, and flies. And she came to one guy, and he said, oh, I can heal, but there's a really good healer just outside of town. And the Buddha was there, and she came to the Buddha and said, can you heal my baby? And he said, well, put her here. And he put his robe down, and he said, oh, yes, let me see. Yes, I think I can. I just need a couple of things. Will you go and get them? These are what I need, but they have to be exactly like I say. You have to bring me this medicine and this medicine and this medicine and some black sesame seeds. Oh, and by the way, and she's like so happy because those are all things she can get, and she's running toward the town. And he says, oh, by the way, the sesame seeds have to have come from a house, which is like was the most common thing. The sesame seeds have to have come from a house where nobody has ever died. Oh, good, she says. She runs to the village. She's so happy now that people talk to her. And she says, I've come for this. Oh yeah, we've got that. Oh yeah, we've got that. Okay. And oh yeah, and black sesame seeds. Yes, yeah. Oh, of course nobody has ever died here. I thought, yeah, my little boy, don't you remember? He died 5 years ago here. You don't remember that? Oh, it was so sad. Oh, well, I'll take these, but I can't take it. I'll come back and talk to you later. I can't. And next house, oh yeah, my grandfather died here, you know, just 3 weeks before your daughter died, and you know, and, oh yeah, and everything, oh yeah, oh, we're just on our way to a funeral. By the time she'd gone through the whole village, she had heard it so many times, and she was open and she wanted it. She suddenly understood. And she went back to the Buddha, and she bowed to him, and she said, okay, teach me what I can do. That's in the Sutta. Beautiful stories. Meeting a shoemaker in further south in India who had a really good temper. He was like good. He was like really good temper. He was very good temper. And he's like making the shoes, and stupid bastard over there. Asshole should be making me make shoes like this for him. What's the matter with him? Does anything? And the Buddha said to him, so which would be easier, to cover the world with leather or to wear shoes? And all those kinds of stories are in the Sutta Pitaka, and some are long and some are short, some are little one-liners, and some are, you know, all very beautiful. And then the last part of it is called the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the basket of rules. And not only does it have all the rules to be ordained, it tells you the story of why those rules came into being. So if you're ever in a community and having a little problem, I'm telling you, here is the book that will show you how a fairly bright guy with pretty good understanding and a certain amount of psychic power was able to bring a community together who were people from the most diverse backgrounds, some untouchables, some royal family, fighting with each other, vying to be the best, fighting with the Buddha. You know, this motley crew with no visible means of support. They come rolling into town. And one time they came to this one, it's because he would just go walking and these people would start following him. They weren't going to follow him far, but they were just following him. Just somewhere, you know, down the road, nothing much, you know. So like 3 years later, they're still following him. And then after a while, some people, when he comes to a town, they say, they rush out when they hear him coming near the town, here he's coming near the town, and they show him they've made this beautiful campsite for him outside of town. So he thanks a very, and we're bringing food out to you. Oh, and some robes out to you. And so this goes on a few times, and finally he asked somebody, why is this happening? And he said, well, they say, well, you know, you've done a really good job, and we're really happy, and blah, 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 and you've given us such good advice, and blah, 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 but you know, last time you came through town, all the laundry that was on the lines all disappeared. You left town, it was all gone. Because if you have no visible means of support, and there's like a new shirt, and you know this is the most important thing in the world, I mean, it doesn't matter about that, you know. And all the food disappeared. So then he says, bhikkhus, and bhikkhu is a very great, interesting word, because it actually means beggar. Like street person is what it essentially means. Mm-hmm. Oh, you bums, get your asses over here. Right now. Now then. And one of my favorite rules, I guess, one of the many, they're all good. It's just amazing because every rule has a story about why it came into being. If you've ever lived in community, this book is great. Any family is a community. And so there was this tendency, this one monk who was an okay meditator, but what he really liked about meditating was the psychic powers, like he really got off on them. So he got very good when it was meditations on the psychic powers, but the rest of it wasn't so interesting to him. And so then he would, and when he went through town on alms round, he would mention about how when he was meditating he had a dream about which horse was going to win. Just casually, you understand? Yes, I dreamt the number of the winning horse in next Sunday's race. Quite a good purse riding on that, I think. And then everybody said, oh, bhikkhu, what would you like? What would you like? So when anybody else came along, there was nothing left. And then there were the people who were being holy and thought, you know, that's fine, I'm better than him because I don't eat. And then there were people who were being unholy who were saying, I am better than him, I steal some from him because he's just as good as stealing it from, you know, and all the different. And eventually word got to the Buddha, somebody came and talked to the Buddha about it. And so then, no, you bhikkhus, come here. They all gather around and, you know, if you're going to practice meditation, you are not allowed to speak about your meditation reports unless it be to a teacher or for some instruction, but not to people who don't meditate. One of the rules. Isn't that nice? So before he died, they had all these questions. First of all, before he died, the Buddha, is this interesting to you? Before he died, the Buddha was thinking, well, I'm getting pretty old now, and, you know, I got this sort of poisonous stuff going on, and, you know, I could work and move it through and stuff, but it might not be the best idea, you know, I'll see whether, and he goes to Ananda, his cousin, who was so devoted to the Buddha. Okay, so tell me, Ananda, have I given you enough teaching, Ananda? Ananda said, Lord Buddha, if I lived another 100 years, I don't know if I could use it. Oh, you have been such a great teacher. It is incredible. Good, says the Buddha. He goes to this one, he goes to that one, and he also, oh, Lord Buddha, how incredible it's been, more than my wildest expectations. Just the first day the teaching you gave me was enough for a lifetime. Good, says the Buddha. So he does his rounds, and everybody tells him how wonderful his teaching has been. So he says, okay, obviously I've done a good job here. They should have a bumper crop. I'm, you know, getting old. I'm not feeling great. I'm out of here. So he calls them all, and he says, well, you know, I'm leaving in, you know, so many hours or something. I can't remember.
What? What?
I mean, oh, really? Where are you going? Oh, wait a minute now. Just a minute. And so then they all scuttle around and go and talk to each other in small enclaves, and they talk to Ananda, his cousin, who was so devoted to him. And they say to him, Ananda, what can we do? We can't. I mean, we gotta go and ask him who will be our leader. And he goes, they ask the Buddha, and Ananda mentions that he's not sure whether they don't still need him. And the Buddha said, but you've all said you've had enough teaching. And he says, well, who's going to be our leader? And he says, well, let the Dharma be your guide. And then so they come back, and then they say, oh, he said, let the Dharma be your guide. And they say, okay, well, but what about the rules? What about the rules? I mean, all those rules that he put together for us to help us. What do? We always talk about how we want to go through them and sort them out because we don't need them all now. What do we do with that? And he goes back and he says to the Buddha, well, what about the rules? Like, you know, we were going to sort them out for the last, you know, kind of like the junk drawer that you keep meaning to sort out. There's a few things in there I don't really need, but every time you start going here, oh, remember this. So they ask the Buddha, and he says, oh no, you can sort it out. You've had enough experience with the Dharma. You have a really good sense of what works and what doesn't. You figure it out. It's fine. So then he says, carry out. What does it say? Oh, I thought you knew it. Carry out your own salvation with diligence. Mm-hmm. He says, okay, now, you do the work you need to do. Very beautiful. And he dies, lying on his right side, smiling, and he goes, bye, it's been fun. So then they start going through the rules, because they're going to change them. And every rule, somebody found a reason why it was really important. So they're all still there, and all their stories. And it is so, it's such interesting reading. Some people find it really boring. I think it's like one of the most exciting books of the Buddhist tradition, the Vinaya Pitaka. So in there you see this, all the rules develop about, you know, about what to write or what not to write, what to lie about or what not to lie about, or what is lying or what isn't, or what you wear or what you don't, and all the stories about how this lie came up or that lie came up, how you use meditation and how you don't. I think some people, they use meditation just to drift off into bliss states. You could see how that would happen, can't you? If you actually got, so you could find the button to push to just go into bliss. You know, after a while you wouldn't even be so, other people would almost look like ghosts to you. Mm-hmm. You know, bliss is profoundly wonderful, but compassion is also essential to establish the living quality of that holiness. So all those stories, they're all in the Pacitica, and they're all very, very beautiful. So I have one last thing I was thinking of talking about tonight, so now I'll make it very brief. Is that all right? Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Okay. In the Buddhist tradition, what you are essentially asked to look for is to see things as they are, with compassionate, non-clinging awareness. That is essentially the whole of the belief system of Buddhism, regardless of the school. There are many ways of couching that teaching. But essentially, what your beliefs are in God or non-God or saints or non-saints or self or others, those are whatever your personal business is, will probably change over the course of your life. But the essential main factor that one is interested in exploring is to see things as they are, with compassionate, non-clinging awareness. That means that you have to start by looking at what is your body.
What is your body?
What is your body? Why do you have to start there? Because everything you see, everything you hear, everything you smell, everything you taste, everything you touch contributes to everything you think. Doesn't it? And everything you think contributes strongly to everything you believe. Doesn't it? So first you want to check and know, well, how do I know that if I tasted this, this is the right taste of it? If you've ever been around, lived with anyone who has cataracts, have you, any of it? Mm-hmm. And when they got their, did they get their cataracts operated on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did their sense of color change after that? Did? Remarkably. I had a very dear friend named Mrs. Rapp, 20 years ago, who built a house, or had a house built for her, and she was going to paint it. And she had this exquisite sense of color, incredibly wonderful sense of design and space and color, beautiful. And she was in her 80s at this point, and she was building this house. She was painting this house, and she picked exactly the right, no, that's not the right color, that's not the right color, I told you what color, no. And finally, we brought her this really ugly, putrid color, which was not what she was describing. And she looked at it and said, there, that's the right color. And then she went and had her cataract operation. And then she came back from having her cataract operation, so she saw happy home, and she walked her in her room and went, ah! Who put that paint on my walls? It was so ugly. Because it's kind of like lime green sort of sludge comes over your eye. And it happens so slowly, you don't even know what's wrong with the world. There's this horrible smog settling in everywhere. No? So how do you know by your senses? If most people, what, one-third of men are colorblind? Is it something like that? If one-third of men are colorblind, how do all men know what is blue and what is green?
Through relationship here.
Exactly, but not through personal experience. Exactly. In my relationship, it looks like this. Therefore, that's what everybody calls green. Therefore. So how do you know anything? So the first thing you have to do is you start looking at the body. You look at the body and making this fairly quick. I'll go into it more tomorrow. You look into the body, and then eventually you find yourself taking the body, takes you right into feelings. Feelings being five, basically seven sometimes, but five for sure if you're Buddhist. They're, I like it, I dislike it, physical. I like it, I dislike it, and I'm neutral, mental. Five feelings. Like and dislike. Pleasure, pain. And neutral mind. Those are the five feelings that you have. When you start exploring those five feelings, you realize that they essentially are conditioned. You can like something really well until some loud noise happens and something falls out of the cupboard and hits you on your head when you're taking a bite of it, and then after that you don't quite like the taste of it. True? So like and dislike are also totally depends on conditions, on relationship. So, okay, perception. When you're in a really good mood and you walk in your house and you left the tap running, oh, for goodness sake, you're in a bad mood and you turn the tap on and you forget and you come back in and it isn't even running yet, but it could, oh, God damn it, I don't know what to happen. Right? Same tap, same surfaces.
Like, what's the difference?
Sometimes when you're happy about something, the room is big and cheerful, even if it's raining, or when you're unhappy about something and glum, it's like no point in even getting happy about it because it's going to get dark again soon. Yeah. Perception. So what's perception? And then what are all these kind of urges and, you know, what I like to call seeds of karma, looking for a place to happen? All these, like, energies and past experiences looking for a way to come into being. What are all those, these mind states, these moods, what we call emotions, what are all they doing? Are they logical? They can seem like it, but only if we hold the story. But the story changes, doesn't it? I remember the first time I actually went to a class by my teacher, and it was a really damn interesting class. It was really, really far fucking out. It was really amazing how far, you know, and I mentioned it to everybody around, and all the groupies gathered around him in the front, so I'm making my way to the door because I'd only gone because a friend of mine wanted me to go. And already I'm forgetting the shock I had when he spoke right to my heart in the middle of this whole other class. I'm picking my way to the door, making a story out of it in my mind, getting it all brushed up. And I know he's up there, he's safe. And so I'm like, oh yeah, far out, man. Yeah, far out. And so he says, so how'd you like the class? And I'm all ready to say, oh yeah, far out. And I turn around and it was him. I thought he was there. And he's there. And it's him. But I go, oh, you know. And, you know, my girdle, which I hadn't worn, I think, ever, was suddenly too tight. And my stockings, which certainly I had given up a long time ago, the seam wasn't right, you know. I had bad breath on the bra. My bra straps, which, of course, I never wore. You know that kind of? All this unfinished business from the past, all these possible ways that you could have, you know, forgot to change your underwear in case you were in an accident, all those ways. They're all like booming right up there whenever there's an opportunity, aren't they? You know, the elevator in New York closes on just at one time and all of a sudden all these ideas come in your mind, or... Is that true? So, which one of those is set? It's like an ocean, isn't it? It's like, you can't say just this one or just this one. And the consciousness that these are dancing in, what is it? All of them, you can't separate one from the other four. But all of them are there all the time. So then you have to find a new way to look. So you start watching. And you realize, actually, that if you watch
for example, the perceptions and the passions, and you get yourself unattached to the perception and just watch the passion come and go, that it's essentially just happening in this clear mind that can just watch it, kind of like watching a pool where the fish are swimming and not being caught or uncaught by them, just aware of that clarity of the flow of things coming into being and passing away. Or like you're watching the screen that the movie is playing on. And you start to understand, oh, this is the clarity of mind. This is just watching something like you do when you're in shock, you know? You know that sense? You're just watching it. Yeah, you're practicing. Yeah, it's harder to do it when you're not practicing, but it begins to give you some confidence in the process. Well, if you do that for a little while, you could develop a really a good sense of what is clarity. Then you start watching, looking at the clarity itself rather than just watching things come and go. You start to try to say, well, what is that clarity? And you realize it doesn't have any fixed identity. And you look at that aspect of it, and you look at it, and you pretty soon you become aware of like the no-thingness of everything, the verbness of everything. And you notice that clarity, there's clarity, but when you really try to examine it, you become aware of what they call in Buddhism emptiness. And you look at the emptiness for a while, and then after a while you kind of get a little, and then some, you say, well, what is it that's looking at it? And you realize it is clarity. So one teaching says, first you develop the awareness of clarity, and then you seal clarity with emptiness, and then you seal emptiness with clarity, and then you seal clarity with emptiness. Then you seal emptiness with clarity, and you carry on in that way until one time you look, and you see non-dual wisdom, clarity and emptiness without separateness. Called non-dual wisdom. So at that point, there is no subject and there is no object. Neither is there not subject or object. It is what they call transcendence, but there isn't really a word for it. And according to my teacher, we practice that. We practice transcendence. We practice it over and over again. That's the path. That's what I was going to talk about in short form. I go into it more.